This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with the Michigan City Area School Superintendent Barbara Eason Watkins. The school district has picked up another Innovators Award from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana. This time, it's dealing with their special high-tech expansion program called One. One device, one student. We'll find out more from Superintendent Eason Watkins. Also, a conversation with LaPorte Pastor Ned Locks, who is the president of the PAC Center, about how the center is doing these days and a new project coming up in LaPorte. We'll also talk with Jesse Carbonda, who's the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, on what Indiana will be like if the Trump administration gets rid of the Clean Power Plan. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana has come out with another list of innovator awards for the month, and one of them is going to some people we've talked to in the past. The Michigan City Area Schools, in particular, have picked up an award to continue their innovative way to get youngsters in the school district ready for jobs and life in the 21st century. This time we're talking about a project that has been able to incorporate a lot of high tech with improved education. And that's what got them the award this time around. With us to talk about it, we have the superintendent of the Michigan City Area Schools, Barb Eason Watkins. Barb, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, for people who are not familiar with the MCAS, describe the school district just briefly first, and then tell us how you all have incorporated the latest technology, and in particular Chromebook computers, into this very innovative way to get youngsters taught and help them prepare for life in high-tech jobs in the future.
Well, our district has 8 elementary schools, 2 middle schools, 1 high school. We also have the Career Technical and Educational Center for LaPorte County. We have approximately 5,400 students. And our district ranges not just in Michigan City, but it also encompasses many of the neighboring communities as well, which is why it's called the Michigan City Area Schools. And we have a great group of business leaders, educational leaders who are supporting our efforts, which is why we're talking about it today.
Mm-hmm. One of the ideas I know that has been brought up in the past in other school districts is to be able to provide students with digital textbooks, so to speak, and computers, and in the hopes that will help them with their studies as well as their performance in the classroom. But I know that the Michigan City Area Schools has taken it at least one and several steps further ahead in establishing a very interesting type of school district that involves not only high technology, but some of the traditional terms of learning as well, too.
Absolutely. We were really excited that this fall, Michigan City High School became one-to-one, and that actually means that each student in our high school has a Chromebook device that they're able to use not only in class but also at home. And it's really enhancing the learning opportunities for our students. We're not doing away with the traditional textbooks. We still utilize traditional methods in our classrooms, but it allows them to access so much more. Their courses are now online. They're able to do additional research so that they can find some things that would not necessarily be available to them. They're able to communicate with teachers as they're working on group projects. They're able to connect with their peers in the classroom. And just overall, it's helping them to organize their thinking, to really make some exciting presentations, things that will prepare them if they're going on to college. It will prepare them for that. Or if they're going directly into the workforce, they'll be fully prepared for that. And so we're just extremely excited that Michigan City High School, and it's going to filter down as well into our middle and elementary schools, mm-hmm. will be prepared for the digital society that they will be a part of.
I noticed that in the information here about the Innovators Award that's come out here, it talks about a term which I had never heard before but makes sense, which is called blended learning. Tell us how that fits in with what the Michigan City Area Schools is doing now.
Well, with blended learning, we're really trying to ensure that the students are able to access all options that will give them the information and the opportunities for learning that exist. So they may have a traditional course book. They are able to go online and they can research other topics. Their teachers can access and enter additional content for them. They can go directly into a museum, for example, that may have information on a particular content area that they're working on. They can go to other resources and see things streamed live as well. So it really enables them to really extend their classroom into the entire world.
I know, too, that the projects that get involved with high technology there in the Michigan City area schools also involve what are called Chromebooks. And I've heard that term before. Tell us about a Chromebook computer and who gets to use these now.
Well, the Chromebook is actually what you just said. It is a computer that our students are able to utilize. Right now, every high school student that attends Michigan City High School has one that they can use, again, at home or in the classroom. In our middle schools, we now have Chromebooks available to all students in their core subject areas. We've also begun to reach down into our middle schools and our elementary schools as well, so that they have carts where the classrooms by grade level are able to utilize these Chromebooks on carts. And they have a classroom set available so that our students are able to take advantage of the broad learning opportunities.
So this way it gives the youngsters in the elementary schools a chance to experience what it is working on these Chromebooks. And this way when they advance on to intermediate or middle schools, and then when they finally get on to high school, they'll be experts at this.
Absolutely, and we were really excited. Last May, we were able to work in partnership with the Economic Development Corporation of Michigan City, the Unity Foundation, Horizon Bank, and our after-school partners, both Safe Harbor and the Boys and Girls Club, to sponsor what was called a Week of Code. Mm-hmm. And every student in the Michigan City area schools from grades kindergarten through grades 12, they were taught how to code. Back in my day, we would call it programming. Now they call it coding. Yeah. And it was just a really exciting opportunity. Over the weekend, we were able to sponsor workshops for individuals within the community who also wanted to enhance their skills and learn how to code. We've been extending this opportunity over the summer. Both the Boys and Girls Club and our Safe Harbor programs were able to expand these opportunities into that program. And more recently, the Alcoa Foundation, which is the Arconic Foundation, is now going to be funding efforts at our local libraries. We have both the Michigan City Public Library and the LaPorte County Library, and also our after-school programs, Boys and Girls Club, Safe Harbor, so that we can have Coda Dojo clubs available so students can extend that opportunity. So we're really excited about the opportunities that we've been able to have, you know, for our students here in Michigan City.
Well, I can certainly understand why. We're talking with Michigan City Area Schools Superintendent Barbara Eason Watkins about the what is called one-to-one, which is basically it's an opportunity to bring a device to a particular student, and the program that's set up at the Michigan City Area Schools. And then through the services of not only the school district, but also some community partners as well, too. I'm going to talk a little bit here about that in just a moment here. But I understand, too, Barbara, that this whole project, the one-to-one project, is really part of a much, much bigger and more expansive project in the district. It's about a $10 million five-year technology initiative. Take a moment and explain what that is and how that all fits together.
Well, let me just first say that we are so appreciative of the investment that our city is making in our technology effort. The Michigan City Redevelopment Commission, the Michigan City City Council and Mayor, and also there have been other local partners have stepped forward to ensure that we had the resources not just to put devices in the hands of our students, but to really transform teaching and learning. And in order to do that, you know, it included ensuring that we had staff development for all of our teachers over this time period, because we wanted to ensure that they were able to utilize and optimize the use of these of the technology in their classrooms in terms of the content, the learning opportunities, and things that they could make available for all of our students. And even some of our amazing teachers have been writing supplemental grants so that they could add to the opportunities that our students have. We've been able able to put Wi-Fi in all of our buildings, and we've been able to enhance some of the file servers that exist. And in our younger classrooms, in kindergarten through grades two, we actually have interactive whiteboards that are available. One thing that we've also been doing is ensuring that our students are not only benefiting from the teaching and learning experiences. We have a new high school course where our students are being trained to provide technical support for the use of these devices in a building. So rather than having to call out to a company to come out and fix, or, you know, really look and see what needs to be done to ensure everyone is able to get online and access the information, we have our own tech team of high school students that are ready, willing, and quite capable of providing that service for us. So it's really a comprehensive effort that has gone into this, because when you just look at some of the work that has taken place in some places where they simply handed the students devices, it wasn't as productive and effective as it could have been. And we did a lot of research on what's working, not only across the region, but across the country. And this type of comprehensive support is what's making a difference. And so we are just thrilled to have had the resources that were made available through our great city to ensure that we were able to provide our students with these opportunities.
Now, Dr. Eason-Watkins, with this project that is already underway and has picked up the recognition that it has, what's ahead now for the involving high technology, not only within the Michigan City area schools, but the rest of the city of Michigan City, for that matter?
Certainly, you know, one-to-one now only exists at our high school, and so we are now moving down the ladder so that we can service and ensure that our middle school students who have access to Chromebooks, but we want them to also become one-to-one in the coming years. Then subsequently, our elementary students will become one-to-one. We have some exciting, you know, engineering programs. We also, through Project Lead the Way, and we've also been able to bolster some of our opportunities, you know, based on some of the feedback we got from manufacturers and supported by the Arconic Foundation, a computer-integrated digital course that's being taught at the high school. So we want to ensure that we're taking advantage of every possible opportunity to ensure that our students are, you know, college and career ready, but also that if there's a need that exists among our local businesses, we're able to say that the Michigan City Area School student is ready and prepared for the workforce.
Well, you know, I can't help but think that even that high school course that you've just described here, where the students get to learn how to be their own tech support staff members, dealing with the equipment that they're going to be working with or they are working with, I can't help but think that that's not going to be an improvement for them when it comes time to help other community members in Michigan City or look for jobs outside in the world to see that. You know, exactly what they have to know. They've learned how to do it and had to do it in high school. It would be an interesting concept to be able to carry that on into their future careers as well. We're talking with Michigan City Area Schools Superintendent Dr. Barbara Eason-Watkins. The school district is following through as they continue on with their IT and high-tech initiative for the school district with the newest program in the series, which is called One-to-One, where a single device is going to a student as it's starting out in the Michigan City High School. And Dr. Eason-Watkins, thank you for spending time with us to talk about this project and one that's picked up another Innovator Award from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana, and I hope to have you back on to talk about another facet of the program and how it's doing as well.
We're excited that our programs are being recognized by the Innovator Society. We think that we have amazing teachers, a great community, great students, and so we are honored to be able to share the work that's underway in the Michigan City Area Schools.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's turn now into LaPorte County to find out more about the issues of food insecurity, about a food pantry and how it's doing these days, and other activities as well in the communities around, all centered around the PACS Center. And to find out more, let's turn to the pastor of the State Street Community Church and the chief peace officer and president of the PACS Center, Pastor Nate Laux. Thanks for being with us. Tell us, for people who are not familiar with the PACS Center, how it started and what it does these days in LaPorte County.
We have to go back to 2010 when we opened our church in downtown LaPorte, and one of the things we wanted to do is figure out where the deepest need in our community was, and we noticed there's a problem with food insecurity, and so we just opened a food pantry by putting some just a sign out in our front yard that said, you know, free food. And we had about 300 people that showed up that first month. And fast forward now, and the PAX Center has grown out of that. PAX is, of course, Latin for peace. We believe we have a profound and sacred call to be peacemakers in La Porte. And so we feed over about 12 to 1,300 people a month through our food pantry, and we feed a couple hundred people a month in our community meals. We have a community garden system now as well, where we teach kids and give community garden plots to different community members in low-income areas, and lots of different kinds of ways to combat food insecurity and food scarcity in La Porte.
Now, when the center first got started, and the food pantry in particular got started back in 2015, where did you get the food to be able to offer it back to the community?
Yeah, so, you know, our church's mission is to help people in the community. And so we dedicate a significant portion of what we get in each week through our weekly giving to this kind of justice project. But we also, of course, part of my roles in the organization is to go out and get grants and get help from other organizations, other churches, and things like that. And then through the USDA, through programs like Feeding America, we get good purchasing power so that we can buy significant amounts of food at a reduced rate through programs like, you know, through the Northwest Indiana Food Bank, these kind of things.
I was going to ask if you take advantage of the food bank, probably rely on them a lot, as do a lot of agencies now rely on the food bank and based in Gary to be the source of a lot of the items that you get in. But I know, too, that you work very hard, and one of the projects that you have been most proud of is a community garden, which, of course, when the weather is right, can produce a lot of vegetables and fruits and the like that in turn can be turned back into ways to help feed the public.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, oftentimes food pantries can provide food, but it's really just kind of a Band-Aid to help hunger, but not actually helping people live healthier lives or combat some other issues like health-related issues. Typically, the cheapest food that we can buy is also some of the worst food we can give each other.
Yeah.
But
right, so
it's still food, though. So, you know, that's a good thing. I don't want to you know, be too cynical about that, because that's still a good thing. Anytime you can provide food for people that are hungry, regardless of good or bad, it's a good thing. However, we wanted to hopefully, you know, take that a little step further and help help provide access to better food. And so we've done this through our community garden. We had over 40 kids in a community garden program this year, a summer program where they came together and they gardened. They had their own garden box and they had lunch every week together, and they learned all kinds of things about environmental sustainability. They learned about, you know, community development. But we also had 50 boxes for community members that they used. And then we have this area where we call a U-pick area, where anybody in the community that needs can come and pick out of the garden. And then finally, at the Jackson Street Community Garden, we have a share table. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the more popular things that we do. Essentially, it's just providing access for people that have to give to people that might not. And so, you know, at the end of the season, somebody planted a lot of tomatoes or a lot of cucumbers, and none of their friends want any of it anymore, and they've got an abundance coming out of their ears. Well, at our share table, they can bring that there, and then we provide a place for people in need to come get from people that have extra.
I'm sure this is one really, really good way to be able to fight the problem of food deserts. We know that urban areas, although La Porte County is not considered an urban area, it's all part of the greater Northwest Indiana region, and we do know that there are food deserts that do exist here where residents aren't living close enough or don't have the opportunity to be able to get the kinds of foods they need for good nutrition as well as to take care of their families. So this, I'm sure, is a good battle against food deserts.
Yeah, absolutely. So our new project, the Brighton Street Green Space, is right located in the smack of a food desert here in downtown La Porte. Mm-hmm. And like you said, we're this kind of unique community that has rural sensibilities, but also kind of a downtown urban feel in some areas. And so it's kind of hard to identify La Porte specifically as what we are. Are we urban? Are we rural? But we do have a food desert that's a fairly significant part of our downtown area. And so We are starting a new community garden, but it's a green space, so it'll have a building on it, which is our Education Resource Center, which will be able to do more projects like canning and pickling and different kind of education projects for the community, but also kind of increase our green space, increase our footprint for gardening. The demand wasn't able to, we weren't able to keep up with the demand, rather, at the Jack Street project, which is about six blocks away. And so we'll be able to increase our capacity for care at this place. We're very excited about it.
We're talking with Pastor Nate Laux, who is the pastor of the State Street Community Church. He's also involved, of course, in the leadership of the PAX Center at the site, and along with all the community gardens that are set up there and the food pantry that's located there in the port, establishing the new Brighton Street Green Space Project. You mentioned, Pastor Laux, that there's going to be an education resource center, a building that's going to be there. What are the plans for that?
Yeah, so, the current spot has a fairly large former dairy factory on it. And if you talk to anybody that's been in La Porte for many years, they probably remember when there was an ice cream shop there and it was actually active. But for the last many years, it hasn't. And so it's kind of urban blight. It's run down. There's parts of it that are falling down. But there is a section of that building. We're going to tear down most of it, but there's a section that we can save and salvage. And so we're going to remodel that building and turn it into an education resource center. And we will be partnering with other health-related organizations for different classes there, different types of, health-related partnerships, screenings, these kind of things. But we'll also use it for some of our STEM-related education. Right now, our programs typically are geared around elementary, rather. And we want to, as our elementary kids graduate out of our programs, we want to have perhaps some more middle school or high school education. So it'll provide some space for that as well, but also different classes. You grew all those tomatoes, you grew all those cucumbers, and we want to teach you how to pickle. We want to teach you how to can, these kind of things, so that what you grew over the summer can hopefully last you throughout the winter, or at least come close to it.
Now, what's the timetable that you've set up there amongst your colleagues going on this project to get things going?
Much of it's contingent on funds, like any kind of nonprofit funding, and it's an ambitious project. Anytime you have to take down a building and mitigate the land and get that all prepared, just to get started on this, you're $100,000 plus. And however, we are seeking partners, and the church, State Street Community Church, and the PAC Center are, of course, going to put in a significant amount of money towards this project. The goal would be for us to start demolition of the current facility this winter and start remodeling our Education Resource Center. And it'd probably be a two-year timeline before the whole space is done. A lot of it's volunteer-led, again, contingent on community and business partners to help us fundraise and fund it. But if all goes well, hopefully within the next 2 years, it will all be finished. We will have space, just to be sure, though. We will continue to use it as we go, though.
Now, if anybody's interested in finding out more, if they'd like to follow the progress of the project, how can they do that?
Yeah, please do. Visit us at the PAX Center, PAX is PAX.com, or go and search for us online on Facebook, the PAX Center, or go on Twitter. And we're on there as well. And you can find us, and we, of course, update that as soon as there's updates for the project. And feel free to contact us if you'd like to help or find out more.
Pastor Nate Laux, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Nate Laux is the pastor of the State Street Community Church. He's also the chief peace officer and president of the PAC Center. And we've been finding out about how improvements in the center of La Porte are going to make a difference and help feed the community and fight food insecurity and in turn make La Porte a better community to live in. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I was 19 when I had my son, and I just lost my mom, and we were homeless. We had nobody to help us. It's just so hard to bring a child into that kind of situation, to bring them into a homeless shelter. To have nobody to help you. I don't want him to feel that he can't depend on me. I don't want him to feel that, you know, he has to worry about things like that. I don't want him to feel that it's his fault, or even though he wasn't old enough at the time, but babies can still feel your anxiety. They can still feel your stress. And you don't want them to feel that way. You want them to feel like everything's going to be okay and they don't have to worry, because they're children. They shouldn't have to worry about where they're going to sleep at night or what they're going to eat or anything of that sort. When you have a child, that child comes first. Sometimes he eats, you don't eat. That's just the way it is. Even when you have a job, you only get paid minimum wage, and minimum wage is only $7.25 an hour. And depending on how many hours you get, sometimes your checks are only $200 or $300 every 2 weeks. And that is not enough to get an apartment, to feed your child, to buy diapers, to buy clothes, to have transportation. And when you live in Portage, there's no bus transportation to get people back and forth. And most jobs won't even give you 30 or 35 hours a week. Like the Y, they wouldn't let us work over 30 hours a week. And that was only about $200, $300 every 2 weeks, depending. That's not enough to go out there, put a down payment on an apartment, and pay $600 a month. When we moved into the homeless shelter, Gabriel's Horn, in South Haven, I mean, this homeless shelter was really nice. It was awesome, to be honest with you. You had your own room, had your own little refrigerator in there. The people were really, really nice. They wanted to help you. Yes, things could be complicated, having to get along with other people that you don't know and live with these people and, you know, share the kitchen and the bathrooms and the living room. I mean, you had a curfew of 9 o'clock on the weekdays and 10 o'clock on the weekends. You're allowed to have 3 overnights a month. You could have visitors, but they couldn't go in your room, of course. Kids had to be in bed by 8 o'clock. There was mandatory counseling that you had to do, group counseling and individual counseling. You had chores that you had to do every day before you left the house. If you didn't come in on time, they would lock you out. And after so many write-ups, they would have to put you out. I think it was 5 or 6 write-ups that they would say that, you know, it's time for you to go. They helped with transportation. The house mother, when we moved out, she took Jaden to school for 2 years back and forth and took me to work because I did not have a car. And for 2 years, she still helped us every single day. She would come from South Haven by his school all the way to Portage, pick us up, take us all the way back to South Haven, and take me all the way back to Portage. Every day for 2 years, she did that. So they were really nice people. They had us fill out an application for housing opportunities. And then we were on the waiting list for about 5 or 6 months before we got our apartment. Hanging up pictures on the walls and hanging up his crafts from school and decorating his room and making his room feel like it was his own was probably one of the best memories, because he was really excited when we started putting stuff into place and it became his own room with all his toys and his pictures that he made. And was able to have friends come over and spend the night and play with his stuff. I think being a mom is amazing. Like, you never know how much you can love somebody until you have a child. There's no love like it. Like, sometimes you love them so much that you just cry. There's no love like having a child. You don't feel that way about anybody else. That is truly unconditional love. There's nothing like it.
You can find more regional stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. A legislative study committee this week will wrap up its examination of the state's confined animal feeding operations, CAFOs, or the barns that feed hundreds of thousands of animals in some cases, like pigs, cows, and chickens. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports that the hearings have drawn some impassioned testimony so far from supporters and opponents alike.
Many crop farmers say the extra income from CAFOs helps keep family farms alive, but opponents say CAFOs can pollute waterways and emit a debilitating odor. Committee Chair Senator Sue Glick says there is a place for large-scale animal agriculture in Indiana.
But neither the people who are anti-animal agriculture nor the CAFO owners themselves should have a carte blanche to do anything they want.
Glick says a common theme she's heard from past hearings is that people on both sides of the argument like local control over CAFOs.
because they know what the problems are and they know what their environmental situation is, and they should be the ones who have ultimate responsibility for many of these operations.
Glick says the committee's final meeting will focus on its report to the General Assembly, which will likely clear up which local, state, and federal agencies regulate which aspects of CAFOs. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
Indiana has the second highest rate of parental incarceration in the state, in the nation. And one program that is being used as a model is connecting inmates and their loved ones with resources before their release. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that the aim is to break the cycle of incarceration through the continuity of care.
The time lost with children can be one of the hardest parts of being incarcerated. Release means a chance to restore relationships.
The first thing out of their mouth were, my kids, where are my kids? I need to see my kids. I need to check on my kids. I need to know what's happening with my kids.
Rachel Hollick is a senior director at Volunteers of America, or VOA. She says her organization heard this again and again, working with mothers through a program it developed to strengthen families affected by incarceration. Another thing learned was how fragile the time of release was.
Where we have people drop out of services is in those times of transition. And so if we can start them with a support person while they are incarcerated and have that person follow them, the likelihood of them staying engaged in the services is significantly higher.
Those services include addiction treatment, job placement, therapy, and transitional housing. The VOA program was recently redubbed Bridge to Success and is now geared towards men. When Langston Hughes heard about it, he was serving 2 years for a probation violation, his second sentence. He says this time was a lot harder on his 8-year-old daughter.
In my situation, like, my child was hurt, that affected the way that she was around the house, the way she was in school, you know, a lot of acting out and misbehaving, and you know, a lot of that had to deal with me not being there.
Experts say a parent behind bars impacts not just a child's behavioral wellness, but their physical health. The VOA worked with Hughes to lift his daughter's spirits.
They asked my daughter, like, what was she interested to get into? And, you know, she had told them dance school because, you know, she real big on the dance and whatever. So, you know, they was go put her in dance school.
Before prison, Hughes helped his mother and sister financially. The VOA program helped pay some bills.
And it also eased my burning a lot because, you know, in there, it's like you can't do nothing but think. Think and worry. Think and worry is a stress reliever.
Besides stress, more than a third of inmates report a combination of past substance abuse, at least one mental health issue, and trauma. The VOA program involves a trauma-informed care approach. It's not what's wrong with you, but what happened to you. Program coordinator Greta Compton says for men, this can be complicated.
They don't consider it trauma. It's just normal. It's just normal. But it's not normal to see someone stabbed in your backyard when you're 8. You know, that's just not normal and it's not healthy. And so a lot of what we do is help reframe that for them to understand that, yes, this has affected you. Now let's work on it.
Halleck says the work also has to consider a hierarchy of needs.
If I don't know where my next meal is going to come from, and if I don't know if I'm going to have a roof over my head, we're not going to be able to do breathing techniques to focus on my anxiety.
Alex says a child that has a parent who is incarcerated is 8 times more likely to enter the criminal justice system.
For these families, even a single intervention helps boost resiliency and the ability to fight through whatever adverse experiences that they are having.
Langston Hughes has been employed for almost a year now. His daughter lives out of state, but when she comes to visit, he looks forward to parenting in every way.
I don't know if I should say this on the radio, but discipline. You know what I mean? Because, you know, like, she got a, you know, attitude problem. So, you know, try to stir and line her up in the right direction.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting and Side Effects Public Media, I'm Jill Sheridan.
We've heard recently from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that the new administrator in the Trump administration, Scott Pruitt, is making the effort, along with the Trump administration, to rescind the Obama-era Clean Power Plan. What is the Clean Power Plan, and how does Indiana stand to lose in that effort by the EPA to take it away from what's already been enacted? And for that, we're turning to Jesse Carvanda, who is the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, to talk about it. Jesse, thank you for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Chris.
Well, if you will, kind of explain from the HEC standpoint what the Clean Power Plan is and how, if it stayed in effect, how Indiana would benefit from it.
The Clean Power Plan was the most ambitious piece of the Obama administration's effort to tackle climate change. It was the first ever effort in U.S. history to begin to have limits on greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector, which is the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. And the goal was to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about one-third by 2030.
When we talk about something that is as wide-sweeping as this, how does Indiana fit into the picture? I know that we've been working for many, many years, and certainly the HEC and other environmental activists have been working to try to get our air cleaner. And it is, in many benefits, cleaner than it has been in decades past, but still could be improved. And what would have happened probably if things hadn't changed as far as the EPA is concerned, how the power plants and other emitters in Indiana work?
Well, you know, the most important thing is that greenhouse gas emissions have declined in Indiana through purely economic forces, in particular the significant reduction in natural gas prices as well as a significant reduction in renewables, which has gone down by about 80% in 10 years. That being the case, the most practical consequence of the Clean Power Plan for Indiana would have been a significant increase in energy efficiency investment. The heart of the Clean Power Plan was to delegate a lot of authority to state governments to design plans that best met the conditions of their state economies. And any responsible state government would have put a lot of emphasis on energy efficiency investment as it means to cut greenhouse gas emissions, which would have had a dual benefit for the public. One would have been, of course, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by stepping up investments and retrofitting residential places, businesses, factories with energy-efficient equipment. But furthermore, it would have led to reductions in energy bills. And our state has had a significant increase in energy prices over the last 10 years, moving from being about fifth in the bottom in the country to about 25th. And it's been due to a variety of factors, most practically because of the need to replace our aging power plants with new power plants. But this would have been a strategy to really reduce energy bills.
I know in particular that NIPSCO has been trying to enact their plans to not only upgrade their power plants by going to the cleaner resources like natural gas and eliminating some of the older aging power plants, but as I'm sure the case around other utilities in Indiana as well. But what more could Indiana have benefited if the Clean Power Plan wasn't in threat of being eliminated?
The most important thing is the state, if it really wanted to put the interests of the public as paramount, it would have reenacted Indiana's energy efficiency portfolio standard. So One of the most important pieces of Governor Daniels' legacy was to enact Energizing Indiana. It was kind of set in motion in 2009 and was in place by 2011. And what that did is it put place a requirement on all the investor-owned utilities, including NIPSCO, to increasingly and steadily reduce energy consumption in their service territories. And again, the practical effect would have been doing everything possible to make sure that homes and businesses are retrofitted so that we're not needlessly wasting energy and therefore needlessly spending money. So that, again, is the big practical loss for the public in Indiana, to not have that driver or stimulus to investing in energy efficiency.
Now, do you think that Governor Eric Holcomb is liable to go ahead and pick up the mantle that then Governor Daniels had and then reenact Energizing Indiana?
We're not sure. We're getting mixed messages. On the positive side, Governor Holcomb has decided to continue the energy efficiency building code that was put in place by Governor Daniels. Governor Pence had allowed that to lapse. And not continue the significant upgrade in the energy efficiency building code on the commercial side. So Governor Holcomb is wanting that to continue. It's our understanding that on the residential side, there's going to be an improvement in the energy efficiency building code, which is a main strategy across the country to reduce energy consumption and therefore to reduce energy bills. So that's the positive signal. The negative signal is that the governor, despite overwhelming opposition from the public, went ahead and signed SB 309, which was that controversial anti-solar energy bill that was enacted this session.
Was there anything that Hoosiers can do to probably turn the tide at least, maybe try and persuade Governor Holcomb and others who have been winging their way this way, away from the regulations to go back on the interests of cleaner air for all America, for all of Indiana?
Yes. Well, you know, the thing is, absolutely. I mean, these public policies would result collectively, having a clean power plan or having Energizing Indiana, they would, over time, incentivize utilities to invest more in zero-emission resources like energy efficiency, solar, and wind, and that would have public health benefits in terms of cleaner air. But the other piece of it is an economic one, and this is what makes it tragic, the decisions that we've made of late. Indiana has about 48,000 jobs in clean energy, which is a very impressive number, more than we have in machine manufacturing in Indiana. But on a per capita basis, we trail the industrial Midwest in clean energy jobs. And one of the reasons why we believe that's the case is that Indiana does not have the kind of dedicated public policy to make Indiana a magnet for these clean energy jobs. There are signals that clean energy investments need to have in order to come and invest in the state. And while we have some really great signals, such as, you know, steadily improving infrastructure, a favorable tax climate, the one signal that we're lacking is sectoral-specific public policy, like pro-solar energy public policy and pro-energy efficiency public policy. That's a good signal to manufacturers and installers to come in Indiana and set up business here.
Well, it sounds like it's once again time to lobby with the folks in Indianapolis for the changes and make sure that these policy moves are made in benefit of Hoosiers all across the state and cleaner air and cleaner water, of course. And we're talking with Jesse Carbonta, who is the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, about the moves by the EPA to eliminate the Clean Power Plan. Jesse, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Chris, and hope we'll have many of your listeners attending the 10th annual Greening the State House on Saturday, December the 2nd.
A conservative group is going on the attack against its customary Republican Party allies over this year's road funding plan.
Americans for Prosperity is sending mailers to the districts of the transportation chairs in the House and Senate, slamming them for a gas tax hike. Indiana Director Justin Stevens doesn't know if there will be more ads closer to Election Day.
I think there's an appetite for more accountability, but we'll see what happens from here on out.
Governor Holcomb says voters he's talked to are happy to see the commitment to better roads.
There would have been a political price not for us to maintain the roads that we have. When it comes to leveraging our attractiveness, being at the crossroads of America, this is a force multiplier.
Democrats are getting in on the act, attacking U.S. Senate candidate Mike Braun for voting for the bill. Eric Berman, Network Indiana.
Eric tells us that one of the lawmakers getting a letter from the Americans for Prosperity group is the chairman of the Indiana House Transportation Committee, Republican Representative Ed Soliday of Valparaiso.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. Rubber is all around us. So much that we probably don't even realize or notice it. There's rubber in your toothbrush, in your TV remote, in your car tires, in your dog's toys, in your erasers, in your basketballs, in your mattress, and in your sneakers. Why is rubber in everything? Well, the answer to that is that it's so useful. It's flexible, it can stretch and bend, fit to your body, and it repels water. And another thing, it's very, very cheap. But it hasn't always been. On this week's episode, we are meeting a man who spent most of his life in South Bend, Indiana. A Hoosier scientist that solved the problem of expensive and limited rubber and is partially responsible for all the rubber that surrounds us today. This problem-solving Hoosier was named Father Julius Newland. Julius was only 2 years old when his family immigrated from Belgium to South Bend, Indiana, in the 1880s. far, far away from the rubber trees of Southeast Asia, which were producing most of the U.S.'s natural rubber at the time. In the late 1880s, Newland graduated from Notre Dame and became ordained as a priest. Then he went to Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., to study chemistry and botany, the study of plants. For his dissertation, Julius studied the chemical reactions of a chemical called acetylene. At the time, he had no idea how much studying this particular chemical would eventually change the world. While doing Julius's research on the different reactions of acetylene, he combined acetylene and arsenic trichloride. The mixture made him gravely ill and hospitalized him for several days. It turns out, he had accidentally discovered a destructive gas that the United States produced to use as a chemical weapon in World War I, called Lewisite, or the Dew of Death. Thankfully, this gas was eventually deemed too horrible to use in war and was discontinued. Though Julius never intended to create a chemical weapon, a cloud hung over him and his chemistry career for many years. But back to this rubber problem. The world in the early 1900s and before used naturally occurring rubber that grew in rubber trees. These rubber trees were found in the Amazon, in the Congo, and in Southeast Asia, among other places. Rubber was so useful that people did everything in their power to get their hands on some rubber trees. In the early 1900s, King Leopold of Belgium colonized the Congo, mainly to extract large amounts of rubber from the rubber trees there. His treatment of the Congolese during colonization was a tragic period of human suffering. At the time, rubber was such a hot commodity that people did unspeakable things in search of it. One day, Julius was in his lab at Notre Dame, and he noticed a strange odor coming from his experiment. He was passing acetylene through a solution of copper and salts. The scent was so horrible that he reportedly remembered it for the rest of his life. Over the following 14 years in his lab, he experimented with different salts to note the different reactions. He was finally able to isolate an oil from the experiment. He added sulfur to that oil, and he noticed it change into something quite rubbery. This rubbery substance wasn't immediately perfect. Julius attempted to make a raincoat from the material found in his lab, and in his own words, it smelled like heck. But very quickly, this material became extremely useful. Julius and his partners from DuPont Company called it neoprene, and it was the first successful synthetic rubber product in the world. Within 40 years of its discovery, 7 billion pounds were produced, enough to make a rubber band around the entire orbit of the Earth and Sun. In 1940, World War II was raging, but the United States had not yet gotten involved. The Republican nominee for president, a Hoosier named Wendell Willkie, declared that the development of synthetic rubber may be the salvation of America and democracy should the United States be forced into war.
Members of the Senate.
Well, as we know, the United States did enter World War II.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
Newspapers of the era sometimes cited neoprene as a contributing factor to the U.S. victory. It's important to recognize that though Julius invented both a gas that could be used as a chemical weapon and synthetic rubber, it is not his accidental chemical weapon that helped the United States to win World War II. It was the ability to have cheap rubber when the U.S. lost access to natural rubber sources that were controlled by the Axis powers during the war. This shows how developments in science technology can affect our world so greatly. Even more so than weapons of mass destruction. In honor of Father Julius Newland, look around today and notice all of the rubber around you. What would our lives be like without it? Thankfully, because of one Hoosier, we never have to find out. Tune in next time to hear more stories of Hoosiers changing the world. In Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sondra Burton.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk to two experts to get answers to the question, what is the difference between a service animal and a comfort animal? Hope you'll join us for that.
Technology is advancing faster than a lot of us can comprehend. So how do we...